From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Burma hasn't changed much in the last 40-plus years. Its military dictatorship, in power since 1962, has been charged with a growing list of human rights abuses. But after countrywide demonstrations in 1988, Burma did make a few adjustments, opening its doors to investment and tourism. Still, it continues to be ruled by military oligarchs who live lavishly while its population lives in poverty. Thanh Minh U, a Burmese historian who's worked extensively with the United Nations, has written The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma, a look at how Burma has been shaped by its often unexplained and complicated history. It's published by Farrah Straus and Drew, and I'm very pleased it has brought Thanh Minh U to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
In an op-ed piece in the New York Times this past September, you wrote that the UN Security Council should be mindful of Burmese history. Can you explain what you meant by that?
I think there's a sense with more interest in Burma that Burma is in a special crisis right now, whereas I wanted to remind people that in a way, Burma has been at crisis for many decades, and it's important to understand not just where we want to go in Burma in terms of wanting a democracy, wanting progress in a number of areas, but also that we need to understand where today's problems have come from, and to understand both the history of the war in the country and the history of the dictatorship of the country.
So in tackling the problem of Burma, in your opinion, has the international community and the Burmese democracy movement been mindful enough of its history?
I think the Burmese democracy movement was mindful of its history. It started more or less in 1988 with the demonstrations when it was the dictator at the time, General Ne Win, who said that we should consider a return to democracy. And I think people had been at that point fed up with a quarter century of military rule and economic stagnation and increasing poverty in many ways. But I think the international community, while doing a right thing, I think in the beginning in standing up with the Burmese people and supporting their calls for democracy, I think hasn't, over the last 15, 16 years, really thought carefully enough about its strategy and careful enough about the context in which it's trying to promote democratic change in the country.
Well, you're a historian. How is history taught inside Burma today? Would the Burmese people going to school have any sense of the real history of the country?
They have a different sense. It's not necessarily a better sense. It's a very skewed sense because these are based on books approved by the military government. Inside the country, I think there's a much greater sense of the colonial period as being a period of humiliation. There's a much greater sense of Burmese nationalism. There's all kinds of myths in Burmese nationalism about how Burma fell under colonial rule and how it emerged from colonial rule.
To justify the regime?
In a way, to justify the regime, but it's a much deeper thing. I think Burmese nationalism is a very deep thing, and under this military regime, it's been rarefied into a much more xenophobic sort of nationalism than it had existed before. And it's something that colors very much, to some extent, people in society as a whole, but in particular the army rulers, who see everything through this prism of a very defensive, xenophobic nationalism.
There are U.S. sanctions in place against Burma. You were a part of the community that actively lobbied for them. Why have you changed your view on that?
About 15 years ago, I was lobbying very hard for any kind of pressure on this government to change its ways. I felt anything that the United States could do, the international community could do to pressure the government would be a good thing. Sanctions, going to the Security Council, anything. But I think two things changed my mind. First was an understanding that this government wasn't like many other governments in the world who perhaps would feel the pressure of being isolated from the rest of the world because they themselves had isolated themselves for over a quarter of a century quite happily. So in a way, isolation is their almost default and quite comfortable state. And secondly, the longer the sanctions continued, two things would happen. One is that China would fill the vacuum in terms of money that the government needed to stay afloat, and the country would be that much more pulled into China's orbit, which is not necessarily a very good thing for a long-term democratic transition. But secondly, in this increased isolation from the West, not just Western money and Western trade, but also Western ideas and education and everything else, you would see a gradual, and we've seen this the last 15 years, withering away of all kinds of institutions in Burmese society other than the army, which has done very well.
Well, Burma has lots of natural resources, oil, gas, rubies, jade. So business continues to be conducted, but most of it is illicit. Teak is another one, a lot of
there is some illicit trade. I mean, the big illicit commodity in Burma was heroin and opium, but the production of opium has gone down dramatically in the last few years because of government change in government policies.
And Afghanistan has filled
that. Afghanistan has filled that vacuum. It's true that Burma is very rich in natural resources, but it's important not to overestimate that because it has a lot of stuff, but at the same time, it's a country now of 55 million. So even with the sales of more natural gas and oil and other things, it's not enough to feed and clothe, not just feed and clothe, but to ensure that this whole new generation of Burmese who are coming up are doing well and hopefully as well as many of its neighbors were doing incredibly well.
Well, isn't the perception that most of the money is going into the military general's pockets anyway?
I think that's a simplification. I think it's true that there's corruption in the country. I think it's true that a lot of generals benefit from all kinds of things, both legal and illegal, at least many of them do. And certainly the government tries to tax what it can like any government. But simply not trading, simply not investing is not going to do the trick because I think what we're missing is the enormous transformative power that a much less isolated Burma, a Burma that's much more connected with the West through trade, investment, ideas, and other things, would have on this country.
But doesn't dealing with the Burmese government lead to similar problems in North Korea, maybe North Korea being a more extreme case? How can you engage with a regime that you can't trust? I mean, let's look at those elections in 1990. They called for them, and then they didn't honor them. They haven't honored many of the other agreements they've made.
There's absolutely no reason to believe that the Burmese government is actually interested in a meaningful transition to democracy, or that the Burmese government is actually interested in meaningful political change which would make it give up any of its power. I think that's clear from the last 20 years. But I think there are ways of working inside the country, of doing business in the country, of visiting the country in a way that, okay, you might have to pay some taxes you would in any other country, but the net positive result of that in terms of slowly, not slowly, but I think quite quickly, changing the social and economic basis on which this government rests would far outweigh whatever money the government would get. It's not North Korea in the sense that it doesn't control the whole country.
But then we have campaigns against things like the gas pipeline in Burma because human rights abuses have been documented connected to the pipelines being built.
Absolutely. I think if there's – I don't think that any business in the country is good or any trade or any tourism in the country. I think it has to be ethically based, and I'm sure there's specific business projects or trade projects or something which shouldn't take place. But I think in general, I think trade and business and anything that will lessen the isolation will, I think, hurry the day that this military regime goes, because this is a military regime which is very surreal in many ways and I think is only able to survive in its present form because it's created this sort of bubble. And I think once that bubble goes away, once Burma becomes an economy that's growing quickly, that's less isolated from the rest of the world, I don't think that this specific group in power, this military regime, can last very long.
Well, that's the same argument we have heard about continuing to trade with China despite all the abuses, and China hasn't really adjusted all that much. So I guess engagement can work or it won't work.
Yeah, I think it's two things. One is that I think in a way the Burmese government has much less legitimacy than, say, even the Chinese or the Vietnamese governments. The elections in 15 years ago showed that. I think if things started to move, society started to expand, become more dynamic, more complicated, there was a lot more connections to the outside world, I don't think this present government could handle it in the way that the Chinese or the Vietnamese governments could. And at the very worst, you would still have the government, but at least people would be much better off than they are today. And that's the other point of the sort of Burma debate or discussion today, is the extent to which there is now an increasingly desperate and dire need for humanitarian assistance.
My guest is Thant Mien U, who has served on United Nations peacekeeping operations in Cambodia and Bosnia, and then was head of policy planning in the UN's Department of Political Affairs. He's since left the UN, but he has written a book called The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories, with a plural, Histories of Burma, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's look at those histories. When was Burma as we know it today founded?
In some ways, Burma is a very ancient country. I mean, you've had a civilization in more or less what is today Burma going back over 2,000 years, and we see a continuity from that period to the present. And there's a very strong sense in the Burmese mentality that it is a very old country and linked to these very ancient civilizations. It was in the 18th century, late 18th, 19th century, early 19th century, that Burma actually became an expanding empire, conquering Thailand, or what is today Thailand, marching in the west, conquering all of what is today northeast India. And then it was in the later part of the 19th century that Burma fought and lost three wars with the British and eventually became a part of British India for almost a century.
But it had been a source of trade for a long time as part of the Silk Road. Also a major source of jade for China throughout its history.
One thing I try to show in my book is that, you know, in a way, Burma's geography is a geography which allows for isolation if it wanted to. Burma's hemmed in by mountains from three sides. But in a way, it's also a geography which allows for connections with the outside world through the sea and also overlying to China if it wants to. And the history of Burma is a history of periods of connection in which it's often shown great creativity, receptivity to outside ideas and cultures, and also periods like now when it's been relatively cut off. And these have been also generally quite poor periods in Burma's past.
Can you tell us about the court of Arakan and why Persians and the Japanese were struggling for power there?
Well, there's a sense that Burma's always been this very exotic kind of remote place, but many times in Burmese history, like Arakan in the 15th, 16th, and 17th century, was this incredibly cosmopolitan court on the borders of what is now Bangladesh. It had a court of mixed Muslims and Buddhists. It had Persians, as you say. It had people from Japan, from Portugal, from Holland, from all across Asia who were there. And this was this small, very dynamic, quite militant in some ways, mercantile empire that stretched all along the Bay of Bengal. And this was one of many very colorful kingdoms in Burma's past, which all came to a very abrupt halt in 1885 when the British finally annexed the kingdom and removed the monarchy.
Was it as ethnically diverse then as it is today?
It's been always been very diverse. I mean, many identities that you have today are new. Many are very old. It's always been this mosaic of many different peoples and languages. There's over 300 languages and dialects spoken in the country today.
So before the British, was there a central administration that ruled over all these ethnic areas?
There was always a Burmese kingdom with a central court, more or less where Mandalay is today, that ruled over most of what is today Burma. There were parts of what is today Burma that were never part of any Burmese kingdom, and there are parts of, you know, the territory in other countries which were parts of the Burmese Empire at different times as well.
What about all of the ethnic conflict that we've seen since Burma's independence? Were the roots of that, did they go all the way back to
some of it
Arakan?
Goes all the way back. I mean, you had the beginnings of, I suppose, what you could call ethnic-based conflict even as early as the 18th century in a kind of modern sense of the word. But it was the British, when they came in the late 19th century and early 20th century, that ruled Burma in two parts. The lowlands, where most of the ethnic Burmese people lived, were ruled in a very different way than the highlands, where many of Burma's ethnic minorities lived. And by ruling it apart and putting it in two different political trajectories, it kind of set the stage for a very difficult period around independence.
And why were the British interested in Burma? I guess it starts around the mid-1880s.
Yeah, it actually starts a little earlier, because the Burmese kingdom in the late 1700s, early 1800s, was an expanding empire, and it was pushing westward into what is now India, at the same time that the British were also expanding out of Bengal. And that's when they fought the first Anglo-Burmese War in 1824, which led to a big Burmese defeat, but after a very long and bloody campaign.
Lord Randolph Churchill was Secretary of State for India at the time. And we have a Churchill connection here as well. Can you describe King Thibaw, who I remember as a character in Amitav Ghosh's novel, The Glass Palace?
Yeah, he was the last king of Burma. He was a fairly weak king. He had actually been selected and propped up at the death of his father by a reformist group of ministers and nobility at the court, many of whom had been educated in Europe at that time and who saw the writing on the wall and felt that only rapid modernization would lead to the survival of the kingdom. But when they propped him up and tried to push through these reforms, a much more reactionary faction at the court fought back, essentially, and took power. And a lot of the reforms came to very little. At the same time, Churchill, as you said, became Secretary of State for India in 1885, and he made Burma a campaign issue in the run-up to the 1885 general elections in the UK. And as a campaign issue, he convinced or tried to convince people that Burma was a despotic oriental tyranny, and only when the king is removed will things be okay in Burma, and will British business be able to resume its business and make profits in that country.
Because Burma was so full of natural resources. In the end, that's what it comes down to.
But in the end, you know, that was also kind of a myth, as it is sort of a myth today. There was always this overemphasis on the extent to which Burma would be an incredibly profitable country if only the government would change. And at that time, there's this conception like today, if only the top people in the government would go, everything would be okay.
So the British, they already have part of the country, then they go after Mandalay, and of course, we know the song On the Road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play. Suddenly it becomes a cause for Britain.
It's kind of, I mean, there are interesting or sort of, yeah, interesting, curious parallels with Iraq today. There was a sense by some in London that Burma would be an easy invasion, that you could have this very quick decapitation of the top leadership, and there wouldn't be any need to spend any more money or troops wouldn't have to stay very long, and it would be an easy victory for the British. And essentially that's what happened in the beginning. It was a two-week cakewalk. They were in Mandalay very quickly. But then all of a sudden, within a few months, insurgents started to appear from nowhere.
Because there were so many ethnic minorities?
It wasn't ethnic insurgents. They weren't actually quite sure who they were. They weren't sure if they were remnants of the old regime, if they were new nationalists, if they were people, bandits and criminals who were just out to attack British posts. They weren't sure at all. But in the end, they had to pour in four times as many troops as was necessary for the original invasion. It bogged them down for 5 years in bloody fighting.
And you said earlier that the current military junta uses that time as an important moment in its telling of the history of Burma. What happened then? Why is that something that fostered Burmese nationalism?
Well, I think it was an incredibly traumatic experience. I think you have to one has to understand that, you know, for the Burmese, the king, the court, the monarchy, all the religious and ceremonial institutions related to it was at the very center of Burmese life for over 1,000 years. And this suddenly collapsed as the British came and invaded and then put down this very very widespread insurgency. So I think the trauma of that, in a way, colored a lot of 20th century thinking about its past. But also for the military, and for many, I think, Burmese sort of harder line nationalists, it's the sense that it was the British that cut off Burma from a much prouder, martial, sort of all-conquering past. And I think that feeling of sort of hurt pride is also something which colors Burmese nationalism today.
And then comes World War II and the Japanese invasion. We'll take a little break and come back with Thant Myint U, Thant Myint U. His book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma from Farah Strauss and Giroux. Stay with us. We're back with Thant Myint U, his book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma, published by Farah Strauss and Giroux. What was Burma's role in World War II? How did Aung San Suu Kyi's father play a prominent role in that?
In the 1930s, there was a group of very talented students at Rangoon University who became the leaders of the sort of nationalist movement in the 1940s. And they were all very influenced by the big totalitarian ideologies of the day. Some considered themselves communists, others fascists. Aung San Suu Kyi's father, General Aung San, was only 20-something, late 20s when World War II broke out. But he had snuck out and made his way to Japan. And he had tried to get the Japanese to assist Burma in restoring its independence. Japan had already been planning to invade Burma as part of its all-around strategy in Asia.
And Japan often defended what it was doing, its expansion into Asia, as an anti-imperialist action. So was that the way it was perceived in Burma?
I suppose initially. I think at least by these young, energetic university students, they saw this as their best chance for independence. For the Japanese, I think the invasion of Burma was much more about cutting off the Allied supply route to Chiang Kai-shek in China, and also about possibly delivering a sort of death blow to the British by invading India from Burma. But for the Burmese, sure, in the very beginning, they were hoping that the Japanese would come as sort of saviors and people who would restore their independence.
Were there people in Burma who also thought that, saw independence as being linked to the one, the movement being, that was taking place in India?
There was, but in general, the Burmese were less patient than the Indians. And I think Gandhi and Nehru and the Indian Congress leaders were not as attractive to these young nationalists as was, say, Sinn Féin, which was always very popular in Burma. They looked to Stalin and the Soviet Union. They looked to the Japanese. They looked to Hitler. They looked to all these much more sort of militant, aggressive people because they wanted independence quickly, and that was what was attractive to them.
Burma wound up getting independence shortly after India and Pakistan did. And there was the democratic experiment from 1949 to 1962. What about the history we've been talking about? Did that foreshadow the failure of that democracy?
I suppose to some extent, because you had this sort of nationalist mood that was already there in the country. And during World War II and immediately after, it hardened into also a nationalism which saw its uncompromising position against the British as something which had won its independence in 1948. But the tragedy of Burma was that because British policy had divided the country into the lowlands and the uplands, many minority peoples were understandably very skeptical about what their role in a new independent Burma was going to be. So the civil war broke out almost immediately after independence, not just on ethnic lines, because it was also a huge communist movement in the country. So you had a three-way civil war between the Burmese government and the communists, and between the Burmese government and some of the ethnic minority groups who had been trained and armed under the British.
How was your grandfather, U Thant, who was the Secretary General of the UN in the 1960s, involved in the democratic administration?
He had been the headmaster of a school and a journalist in the 30s and the 40s, and he was still a young man at independence, and he had been brought in by the Prime Minister, U Nu, who was a good friend of his for a very long time, to be essentially his confidant, his advisor, and also someone who helped him in foreign policy as well, and he traveled with U Nu around the world a lot in the 1950s.
But then he was Secretary General after the military takeover.
That's right. He had been Burma's ambassador to the UN in the late 50s, and when Dag Hammarskjöld died in 1962, he was appointed first acting and then acting secretary general and then secretary general for 10 years.
62 is when the military dictatorship of Ne Win also came to power. How did it grow out of the democracy? Was it just a coup?
Well, because the civil war had been going on, what happened was that the Burmese army expanded along with the civil war. Burma actually turned to the UN in the early 50s for help. And when they were disappointed with that help, and this was at a time when the CIA was also arming some of the Burmese insurgents, when they were disappointed with that help, they felt they had to do this on their own. So they sent study missions all over the world, came back, bought arms from all over the world, and essentially built up a very professional army under first a democratic government. But by 1962, this army had become this big, professional, very efficient, effective machine, whereas the government itself and many institutions were still quite weak and there was still civil war in parts of the country. And so the army decided, which was not a strange thing in the early 60s, given there were army regimes all over Asia, the army decided it would be better to take over itself and run the country by itself.
But unlike so many military dictatorships, they saw themselves as socialists, although they came up with what they called the Burmese way to socialism.
There were a couple of things involved there. One was like Finland, like some other countries right on the edge of the big communist bloc, it felt it was safer to toe a line that would not lead to Chinese interference in a Chinese invasion of the country. And this was at a time when the communist insurgency was still continuing. Also, General Ne Win, who was a dictator at the time, saw the Vietnam War next door And I think he felt that the policies he undertook were the best insurance against the war in Indochina from spilling over into Burma. Those were the good reasons. The bad thing that happened immediately under military rule was not just the normal sort of repression of free political life, but the very strange economic policies that they came up with and implemented. So whereas South Korea, Thailand, many other countries did quite well, at least economically, under army rule, the Burmese economy nearly collapsed in the 1960s.
They changed a lot of things, even which side of the road you drove on. Well, overnight.
Some of those things became stranger. As Ne Win, who was a very unusual man, unlike the generals today, he actually liked to travel in Europe. He went shopping in Europe. He had a psychiatrist in Vienna that he used to visit every summer. And when he ended his therapy sessions, and also when his wife died, he became stranger, and some of these things happened. But leaving those things aside, I mean, the worst things he did were in the early 60s, when he nationalized all banks and all major businesses. He expelled hundreds of thousands of ethnic Indians from the country.
Because they control so many of the businesses?
Of the businesses. And I think he had a personal grudge against the Indian community. He banned tourists from coming into the country. He banned all inward investment and almost all international trade. He basically cut off the country from the rest of the world. And the effects on the economy are obvious. It went into rapid decline in the 60s. But I think from the outside, what's harder to see is the effects on the overall mentality and the political culture in the country. And I really think that that's the most damaging of all of his legacies.
How does the current regime describe this period of history, if at all?
I think they have mixed feelings. They shy away from describing it very much. I think on the one hand,
kind of like the Chinese with Mao.
I think so. In a way, I think they're reluctant to criticize heavily a part of their own past. I mean, it was the army that was still in power, and Ne Win, who in some ways was the mentor of the generals today. But in other ways, they're trying to show their difference. In 1987, I remember, before the democracy movement began, an army officer said to me, a young army officer, I was 21 at the time, he was in his late 20s, he said to me, you know, what we really want is to move away from being a left-wing, isolated military dictatorship to a right-wing, pro-American military dictatorship. And what they meant was they still wanted the army to be overall in charge, but they wanted to be more like Thailand and South Korea and have economic development, but they weren't quite sure how to do that.
My guest is Thant Mient U. His book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. So how did U Thant react to what was going on in Burma when he was Secretary General of the UN? Did he try to apply any pressure through the UN?
Not through the UN and not through his office. I think he had, you know, in the 1960s, the UN was not only much less involved in what we would call internal conflicts, but almost not involved at all. And there was no history, as there is today, of the UN criticizing member state governments on human rights and things. And he tried to maintain quite a distance from his own personal feelings about what was happening to his friends and colleagues in the country and his professional role as Secretary General.
Well, you were born after Ne Win came to power. Were you born in Burma?
No, I was born here. It was in 1966, and so he was in the middle of his 10 years as Secretary General. My parents lived with him, and so I grew up partly in the same house as him. I lived with him until he died in 74.
And he was honored after he died, which had to be odd, considering the fact that he was really associated with the democracy government.
When he died, it was in New York, and we flew back with his body to bury him. And Ne Win was very jealous of him and his international stature. But always they were also two men who never were very close in any way. And Ne Win chose not to honor him. And it was the decision by many students and ordinary people to take matters into their own hands and to demand a public or state burial and ceremony for him that led to a lot of bloodshed in 1974, around the time he died in December 74.
What led to the demonstrations of 1988?
A couple of things. I think people were more than sick and tired of 25 years of both army rule and declining living standards, especially in the cities and especially for the middle class. But I think that was combined with a certain element of hope. I think it was the frustration as well as the hope. The hope because of two things. One is in the wider world, I think people had heard of the revolution in the Philippines. I think there was a sense that history was on the side of democracy and political change at the time. But also it was General Ne Win himself who stood up one day and who said, I think maybe, he didn't say he had made a mistake, but I think maybe we should consider a return to what he called a multi-party system of government. And that gave people the hook or the opening. And that led to massive demonstrations, which were then put down very brutally by the military.
Because they realized they'd opened up a door that would be hard to close?
I think so. I think it genuinely shocked them. I think because the demonstrations led to almost a social revolution in the country. These were hundreds of thousands of people protesting. I would think not so much for a democratic system, because very few people at that time had lived under a democratic system, but for change and for something better than what was there at the time. And I think when the demonstrations started to become violent, especially, I think it scared a lot of people in the military. They clamped down, and then they weren't quite sure exactly in what direction to move right after the demonstrations in 88.
What impact has the popularity of Aung San Suu Kyi outside of Burma had on the junta's policies? And were they affected at all when she was given the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991?
Absolutely. I think by the time she had won the Nobel Peace Prize, she was already by far the most popular opposition leader in the country.
Well, she won the election.
And she'd won the election. But this cemented her status, because I think for ordinary people, for many people, it gave her a sense, it gave them the sense, and this has a good and a bad side, that she was supported by the international community. For the military, what that meant was that she was not to be trusted, that she, for them, you know, to some extent, she was a foreign agent and possibly controlled by the U.S. or the powers that be on the outside. And for a lot of people who opposed the government, I think that led perhaps to an overestimation of how much the international community was actually going to deliver, that actually more than sanctions, they were actually going to come in and do something. And it led perhaps, unintended way, to a lessening of more active sort of resistance to the government.
Well, the sense now is that the country has been relatively quiet over the years. Is that just because we don't know what's going on?
I think there are two things that are important that are often not talked about outside. One is that, as we said before, there's been this civil war in Burma since 1948. And then something amazing happened in 1989, which is that the government's number one battlefield opponent, the communist insurgents, fell apart. And the government was, on the back of that, able to negotiate or pressure 17 different insurgent groups into ceasefires. And so in the early 1990s, for the first time in nearly 50 years, almost all the guns in Burma went silent. And that was actually a major turn in Burmese history.
And then we had some other changes. The name of the country was changed to Myanmar, although almost everyone outside of Burma resists. And then last year, the government moved the capital from Rangoon to a more remote location in the north. And I wonder whether Burmese history explains that decision.
I think it's hard. I think to some extent it's a legacy move, in the sense that the generals who were in charge, of the top general who's in charge right now, General Than Shwe, wants to show that he's creating this new Burma that's different from what existed before. I think he sees his legacy as two main things. One is that he will be the one to end the civil war. The second is the one as the person who tried to open up the country to the outside world and to the international market and to outside trade and things. And then he sees this as a kind of a symbolic kind of cap on that legacy. I think he's less aware of all the problems that have existed in his 10 years in power so far.
Now, you're a controversial figure amongst Burmese emigre groups. What have you done to upset those people?
Well, I think many of the people, maybe not most, but I think many of the Burmese exiles believe what I believed 15 years ago, in the sense that only very hardline pressure on the government will work, and that sanctions are an effective form of pressure. And I disagree with that. And I also feel very strongly that it's an easy way out for many Western governments. I think.
Well, it worked in South Africa. It's worked in some other countries.
I think it's different. I think you cannot compare the white minority in South Africa to the Burmese military, which is so much more, I say, for them, Burma is the whole world. And for them, any interaction with the outside world is actually something uncomfortable. So in that way, sanctions don't pressure them. But what sanctions do is it undermines further the capacity of Burmese society and institutions to actually see through any kind of transition in the future.
More like what happened in Iraq, where the sanctions really didn't topple Saddam Hussein. They just simply caused a more and more hardship among the people.
I think if it was the case that, you know, sanctions only cut off the government from certain foreign trade, that would be okay, and perhaps we could play a waiting game and see what happens in 5 or 10 years. But I think the clock is ticking in a certain way. I think Burma is in some ways on the verge of being a failed state, and that if the current situation continues and the isolation continues, no government that's in power, whether it's a military government or a new democratic government, will be able to actually govern the country. This is an incredibly young country. It's a country that's changing very quickly. And the basic institutions of government that you need are simply not there anymore.
Thant Mien Ou's book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, former president and Nobel Peace Prize winner Jimmy Carter talks about what he believes must be done for peace to exist between the Israelis and Palestinians, plus advice on eco-friendly living, and we look at a number of distinctive New York buildings like the New York Public Library and the Metropolitan Opera House that were designed by one influential architectural firm. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. We had help today from Samantha Morgenstern, Angie Sheldon, Brad Ludlow, and Gabriel Galanek. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.